Good afternoon, everyone. If you watch me frantically typing, I'm having fun with DNS. Gotta love it. But I think I fixed it. Knock on wood. Welcome to Same Time and Money, Automate Hyper-V with PowerShell and C#. My name is Brian Randall, and I'm a partner with MCW Technologies. And the whole point of this talk is to see how, from a business perspective, you can be more productive. And by being more productive, that ultimately saves company money. On a personal level, though, save time means you have the ability to get out of the office on time, the ability to do other things while the computer is busy rather than you physically interacting with management tools. So I want to show you just two quick things that, knock on wood, everything's going to behave today. So let's switch over here to my machine. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Maybe we won't switch to my machine. Let's try this again. No, that's not it. We did a test. It was working fine, really. So that'd be very interesting if we have a black screen for the demo. Just thinking. Didn't we check this? Ah, I picked the wrong one. See? It said micro, and I picked up HMI. So there we go. All right, this is Windows Server 2012. And what we're going to do here is dig out a script that I have. And let's see, how about, well, that's not going to work. So let's go with the other thing. So one of the things you can do if you invest a little time programming is you can build something to help you automate what's going on. And that's not going to work because that's the wrong machine name. So we'll give that a second to, there we go, good. And so I'll change my machine name, which in this case is HV530. And do the domain, and since I'm local, it'll just take my credentials. And so what you can see is that with a custom application, I can do a lot of things that the Hyper-V manager can do. And the key about this is not so much that I'm going to duplicate the GUI the way they have. It's that now I have this code library that I can build different experiences behind, whether it be a website, etc. The same thing with PowerShell scripts. Now, if we go over there, you'll look that I have also the DC and this. So what I have here is I have a domain, and I'm running domain control here, and I have another computer joined, and we got some VMs that I can mess with, and we can do some stuff. All right, so first thing to talk about is what tools do you need? Well, the nice thing about PowerShell on the modern operating system is it's built in. You just enable it. You can enable the PowerShell ISE, which is the integrated scripting environment, which supports IntelliSense for typing, integrated command window. If you enable the help commands, you will get help options when you type. And both those items are just part of the operating system. When you enable Hyper-V through the enable role, or if you're on Windows 8 and you do it through add and remove programs, enable Windows feature, you have the option to install the PowerShell modules. They automatically register them so they're available in your standard PowerShell window, and you can go to town and do whatever you want. If you want to write some custom code, then Visual Studio 2012 is out there. Obviously, if you're an IT pro, that's probably not something that you have in, as part of your TechNet subscription, for example. But the key thing is that there is copies of Visual Studio that are available for free to do what I'm going to show you here today. There are paid versions, but there are multiple free versions. In particular, the one version you're going to want to get to build a local GUI or a console app would, and DLLs would be the desktop edition. I'll give you a link to that a bit later. So when we think about Hyper-V and programming it, fundamentally the way Microsoft exposes it is through what's known as a WMI interface, Windows Management Instrumentation. And this has been something that's been around forever in Windows. It's something you can program from native C, C++. There are COM interfaces you can program from VBScript. Microsoft did make it available to you through PowerShell, but it was only in this new release of Windows Server 2012 and Windows 8. There's 164 built-in commandlets, and if you type git command dash module hyper-v, it'll list all available commands that are available. You can also go to that documentation link, and they're all listed, and then you can jump in to each individual commandlet. And those commandlets wrap up what effectively is going to be a lot of calls to WMI if you were to use VBScript, or in the case we look at the application I have here that has VB.NET and also provides C# version, that you can basically just automate a ton of stuff with one line of code. And when you take PowerShell's piping ability, it's crazy what you can do with just one line of script, where if you sat there and did it manually through the administrative tools, you could literally spend hours. Now, the key thing to understand about the new PowerShell support is that it is new. In previous versions, which I'm assuming some of you are still running Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1, hopefully, possibly some of you still running even Windows Server 2008 proper, Microsoft does not provide an official backported solution. PowerShell is available for those older operating systems, but you're on your own in that you're going to have to program WMI from PowerShell directly. Thankfully, someone else thought that was a kind of crazy lifestyle to lead, and a gentleman named James O'Neill, who is a former Microsoft employee, he created a set of PowerShell libraries and published them onto CodePlex. They're widely used out there. In fact, one of the things you have to do is, let me guess, some of you occasionally use your favorite search engine to find tips and tricks and how to do things. You have to be careful because someone will say, oh, here's the PowerShell script to do this. And they'll leave out the version of the operating system they're doing it against. They'll just say Hyper-V. And they'll, you know, use the library. And what's funny is James, a lot of his commandlets that he created have the exact same names as Microsoft's in the official Hyper-V library that's available in Server 2012 and Windows 8. So it's one key thing to keep in mind is when you are looking at the documentation or looking at things on the internet, be careful where you're getting it from and have a look there, because there are definitely some commandlets that are in his library that don't have moral equivalents and vice versa. Now, when you go to work with Hyper-V in 2012, life is just much better. You have basically two simple choices. You can be a local administrator, and that will let you manipulate Hyper-V using the command line tools, et cetera, from a Hyper-V permission level. We have some others to talk about PowerShell. If you have USC enabled, which you really should, then you will often have to enable that to get full access. Now, what's interesting about that is that some of the commands will do stuff without you running UAC, but you will find that some of the data will be limited. Now, the other thing to do is be a member of the local Hyper-V administrators group. Now, the nice thing about that is you can be a member of that group and not have to be a local administrator. Okay. However, because of the fact that Hyper-V obviously has a set of specialized features, and then, oh, let's say you decide to do something extra, like you want to examine available memory and shut down a process or do something else, you might need elevated permissions for an alternative PowerShell command. So the happy lifestyle is that, yes, you're a local administrator and you're a member of the local Hyper-V administrators group, but the key is you don't have to be. That's not now the mandatory thing that you have to do. Now, this isn't a session on PowerShell, but there's just a few key things that I thought were important to talk about in the context of programming Hyper-V with PowerShell. The first thing is the standard PowerShell script execution policy. So obviously, scripts can do dangerous things in the right security context. So out of the box, the idea of executing a script is disabled. And you basically have four choices to do it, and it's through set execution policy. And set execution policy, it's a very simple command. You just pass one of those parameters that are bolded there. Restricted, which is the default, just says you can't run any scripts. So you cannot take a text file and pass it to PowerShell and say execute the command stored in there. The next option is all signed, and this basically means you have to sign it with a code sign cert that is trusted by the local machine authority. The bottom line that means is if you want to do what's easy, in other words, you don't have to do any certificate management, then you sign it with a code sign cert from someone like VeriSign or Thought. That said, if you run your own enterprise CA, you can generate your own code sign certificate and sign with your own cert. That cert just has to be trusted. Okay. Now, the next level is remote signed, and this is what generally you'll see, particularly Microsoft, if they provide you with scripts, will say, enable remote signed for our scripts. And what that says is, if it looks that the script came from a remote location and it's signed, it will execute. Otherwise, it's going to block them. And the whole idea is to block a script from being executed, particularly from a web browser. And really, if you put this in context, you really shouldn't be surfing from your servers. But as we're going to see, you're probably going to be executing a lot of PowerShell scripts from your regular desktop, at least if it's Windows 8. I'm curious, by the way, how many of you running Windows 8 as your primary desktop? Oh, okay. More than I thought. Windows 7? XP. Woohoo! Yeah! Land of pain and suffering. Awesome. And by the way, the way that works is when things come out over the remote wire, the built-in plumbing in your OLMON and the built-in INEP DLLs, they put an alternative stream inside to the script file, just like when you download a zip file. And that's basically how they know it. So you can effectively bypass that if you know what you're doing. And then unrestricted, right, hey, it's your life, right? You want to do that? Hey, party on. But obviously be very careful, because now you're saying that, any script from the internet will run, anything you write that has been tested will run, et cetera. Now, that said, to change it, you do have to have administrative rights on the local machine. So in a domain, you need to be a member of the local managers group or just a local member. And finally, get execution policy, something you can call in your code to check to see if you have any rights so you don't just blow up. Although most of the scripts I see, people say, what's this concept of error handling? Nah, screw it. Let's just party on and go for it, and I'll deal with the red errors. So be it. Now, that said, I want to bring up a key point. In PowerShell, we have this notion of what are called commandlets. And I have a quote from the documentation, which is, it's a lightweight command that is used in Windows PowerShell environment. What this fundamentally means is it is a compiled or structured element that has been added to the PowerShell system. In the hierarchy of PowerShell, large groups of commandlets, like the Hyper-V ones, are distributed as a module. The module gets registered as a trusted set of libraries, and there is compiled code behind it. Typically, it's written in Visual Basic or Visual C Sharp. That said, starting with PowerShell 2.0, you do have the ability to write pseudo commandlets, which are officially known as advanced functions. So you can basically write scripts that act like commandlets. And what that means is they're not interpreted as a PS file or a PowerShell script file. They're considered a commandlet, and you can register them with the system. But ultimately, a script is just a text file with a PS1 extension, and we just have one or more PowerShell commands that we're executing, calling commandlets, etc. So when we look at something in the PowerShell editor, I'll be just looking at a script. We won't be getting into writing commandlets. That said, you can do all sorts of wonderful things if you really get into PowerShell and you also happen to be comfortable in one of these managed languages. Now, error handling, bad things happen to good people. Consider, I'll just throw it out there. The typical programming style, and which you'll see most of my scripts do the same thing, is just get to the meat of the subject. I want to get something done. Great. But if you really want to move it to the next level, you can logically group your code into functions, and you can then use try-catch syntax. And it's really straightforward. It's just try, and between the try and the word catch, do something. If an error occurs, what's going to happen is it's going to give you an exception object, and you can examine that exception object to see, well, what went wrong, and then try a condition. And then finally, it provides you a way to clean up. In particular, often what will happen is you'll try and do something, say, open a connection, open a file, etc., and then something bad happens as part of the processing. You go to write some data to the file, but the data you're trying to write from is a null object, right? The object's not initialized. And so when you do that, it fails. And so in the finally block, you can have the opportunity to clean up. So you can close the object, close the file, etc. On that said, you just got to be careful, because there's that always fun bit of, okay, in your effort to clean up, you cause a secondary exception, and life just gets painful. So I'll show you the syntax. It's really straightforward. And come over here. And so you can, of course, use God's editor, Visual Notepad, to edit your scripts. Okay. On the other hand, if you install the Windows PowerShell Integrated Scripting Environment, which on your server operating systems is, as I said, done through the server manager add roles, or of course you can use DISM and do it at the command line, you will get a nice little GUI. And once you have that, you'll notice that we have three windows in particular. You can adjust the layout, and it's, you know, customizable. And what we see here is that I've got my PowerShell window here, so I can say something like git vm. And as I start typing, notice I'm getting IntelliSense. All right, and this is a live window. And so if I run this, it's going to go through and tell me that the name of my host is HV530. I have 8 logical processors. I have 32 gigs of RAM, and live migration is enabled. Okay? So I can do that right there, and then I can also come up here and I can start writing scripts. And as I start writing scripts, I can also get IntelliSense. And if we do something like git vm, I can start getting parameters. So git vm-name, and we could do something like, I think I have 01, I don't know, MDE01DC. All right, and now when I go to run it, there you go. Okay? So we have just a lot of flexibility in this tool, and then like I said, I can then open existing scripts. And so if we go over and open up my try catch, which I got from the scripting guys, try, braces, do your thing, something bad happens. And you'll note you have system.exception. So system.exception is what's known as the root exception. At the end of the day, everything is a system.exception. Everyone here is a IT professional, but you might have an implementation. Sir, what's your name? Mike. So Mike is a, so you can get more specific exceptions. File not found exception. Okay. System.null object exception. So you can actually block these in richer steps. So you can say catch, null reference exception, just like that. And of course, we can do our favorite thing, comments or hash symbols, ignore it, right? Just keep going, all right? And then if you go a little further, you have your finally block, okay? So really simple to do, and granted, get started, and that's all you should do. I write without any exception handling, get my scripts working, fill form, figure out what exceptions get caused. That's actually one of the fun things, right? Unfortunately, there's no easy way to say, oh, if I execute the command, what are the possible exceptions that might occur? There's no magic mojo that I know. If someone knows, I'd love to hear that one. That'd be awesome, right? But in either case, try it out and then just start writing these try-catch blocks. The biggest thing you got to watch out for is object scope. Something inside a try block, if you do a variable definition or initialize something, its scope is only the try block, which means when you go into the catch block, you can't read it, and when you go into the finally block. So if you want, for example, to have an object that you're going to do some work with and you need to open and then close it, you want to scope the variable declaration above the try block, like we did here with OBJ1, so that it's available both in the try block, the catch block, and the finally block. Okay, so think about error handling. Not mandatory, but you're encouraged. That's a great question. They don't work. And if you want to know why, just stay tuned. I will tell you why. Now, the next thing is you've done something with a script. What did it do? Well, it did what the script said. Okay. But how do you know? Because in general, the whole point of automation is that I'm able to run things and not necessarily sit there and stare at it, right, and watch what happens. So one of the things you can do is use the write event log commandlet to write to the Windows event log. Really straightforward. Use ISE to start typing. Probably the biggest thing that's an oddity and somewhat annoying is you do have to provide an ID. The event log has a well-known set of blocks for application IDs, and you know you start in the 3,000 range, and just use one of those is fine. The idea is that you can logically group them into numbered blocks. But basically, specify what you want to log, some message. You can pass raw data, so you can pass binary data. And ultimately, you're just saying, hey, this thing occurred. The problem is you try and use it, and if I try and do it, it'll blow up. So we go over here to there. And we do something like write event log. And then as I start doing this, I can say log name, and we'll do application, and we'll do event ID 3001, message, Ryan was here. And then it says, oh, you forgot to supply a parameter. Oh, what did I forget to supply? Oh, the source. Me. And then it blows up. And the reason it does that is because we don't have an event source defined. So we have to define an event source with new event log. And it's kind of weird because you do source, and we'll call this Bubba. And then you do application, or log name, sorry. And do application. And now I have an event source called Bubba. And so now if I run this up here, and by the way, I'm just pressing the up arrow, and that's going through the cycle list of commands in case you've never used ISE. And I can do source, and I can type Bubba. And now if I go to the event log, go to Windows Logs, Application, there's my new event log ID, and there's the text. Okay? So you just need to be able to get that event source created at some point. Once it's done, your scripts can log to the different to the event log and log information. Of course, you're not limited just to the application log, but you have to have that source defined first. Now, we start thinking about automating, and the script environment is great, and the fact that I can write scripts. But one of the big things that you're going to want to do is be able to process a list of items coming in from a file. For example, if you have 100 virtual machines, it's one thing just to walk up, and with piping, I can walk through the entire list. But one of the things that really annoys me, and this is the thing, I brought this just for fun, but I've got 8 terabytes here. I've got a VM problem, okay? But typically what I do as a developer, I build these demo environments. And the demo environments will be made up of, you know, domain controller, SQL Server, and a bunch of other stuff. One of the ones I'm working on right now, we have 19 virtual machines that make up the entire configuration. And the things we have to do with those is start them, run Windows Update on them. We have to export them for backup, or we snapshot them. And those kind of things, right, well, definitely you're doing 20 at a time. One of the problems is Hyper-V's GUI will actually fake you out. It'll let you select multiple items and do certain commands. But it's not very smart, right? Because what it'll do is just start doing everything at the same time. So, of course, if you're a lot of people, you have, you know, one hard drive or, you know, maybe two. You know, if you're lucky, you have a massive SAN that can handle the IOPS. But you're doing some work, and all of a sudden, you're just, you know, killing your machine. And so what you want to be able to do is say, oh, for this block, I want to do something, and I want to think about it, or I want to do it, or I want to wait for the command to finish. Snapshot one, then two, then three. And so because I have a lot of VMs, I want to create those logical groups. So the simple thing is you create a list in a text file, and what you do is you call get content. Get content will just load it up into memory, and then you have this array that you can basically just loop through and do things on. And you can do things like for each, and then do whatever you want with that particular item. Right? It's simply just the name of the VM that you're working with as an example. So we're going to look at that in some sample scripts that I have. Now the last thing I want to mention is local versus remote automation. Right? One of the great things about PowerShell is that it is inherently designed to manage not only lots of things locally, but remote servers, and thus do whatever you want to do. And the simple thing is that when you look at commandlets, anything that's going to support remote automation is going to have a computer name property. That's just the convention that Microsoft follows. So just prepend dash computer name as your first parameter, and away you go. Naturally, you have to have rights on that machine, and the simplest way it's going to work is going to be a domain. If you're not in a domain, particularly you want to manipulate Hyper-V on the workgroup mode, you've got to basically do some magic mojo. And I forgot to put it on my slides, but I'll put it on my blog. There is a set of scripts that you can download from Microsoft's code gallery that will make it easier if you have to deal with workgroup machines. But in either case, out of the box, remote access is enabled, and you should be able to do things. So for example, if we go over here, right, I am on, as I said, HV 530. But if I say get VM host dash computer name, and we do Odin 12 MBP. Destination host will specify another host and try the operation again. That's oh, we love okay. Here's the funny thing. I'm already peed into it. Come on, you can do it. There we go. Yes, so of course I had things set up this morning. I carried it down from the speaker lounge and you don't like me, but that's okay. It'll work out. It always does. Okay, and so we'll go the other way. Okay, so at least you go the other way. I got some, obviously some network issue. My kingdom for a working network. In either case, you have that remote command. It'll work just as if it was local. Okay. Now, up to this point, I've been doing everything on regular Hyper-V. When I say regular, I've been working with Hyper-V in the roll mode enabled on Windows Server 2012. That's the case of both machines. That said, there is something called Hyper-V Server 2012. If you're not aware of it, it's basically just the hypervisor and enough core bits of Windows to run virtual machines and behave on the network. The key thing about it is it's free. It's a mortal equivalent to various VMware products like ESXi and some of the other servers that do not come with graphical management tools, that are very lightweight, have a character mode, command structure. And when you use Hyper-V Server, you go through some setup, and one of the things you do need to do that's different is, by default, when you use the full version of Windows Server 2012 and you enable Hyper-V, remote access for PowerShell is enabled. You have to enable it with the enable PS remoting commandlet on Hyper-V Server. So it's like one extra step you have to do, and then you can do everything that we're doing here from the remote tools. And then if you take a look at the PowerShell FAQ, and what's nice about this is you can run this from within the PowerShell window, or you can go to this URL, and it documents a lot of different things about remote connectivity and different things you can do as far as remote execution of code. And a lot of the things I'm doing here, I'm going to the server saying, give me some data, pipe it back, and bring it to my local environment. But you have basically as much control as you configure out, with Hyper-V security to do what you want. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is this notion of Hyper-V and WMI jobs. So one of the things that happens with Hyper-V commands that you execute is some are just give me information. For example, the get VM host command is just provided with just a little tiny bit of information. On the other hand, snapshotting a large VM, doing a live migration, those are things that don't just return. And so what they've done is for those type of commandlets, they've internally implemented asynchronous execution. So the nice thing about it is that it's not your problem to cruft up asynchronous code. However, that means that the call that you execute will just return and can return right away with a number. And what that does, that presents what's known as a WMI job object. And you can basically reach up and grab a hold of the job object and use it to enumerate through. Now, let me do an example here of what this looks like. And I'm on the wrong host, so let's go over to this one. And I had a little fun last night at my tech check. You know how people say you should back up stuff? They're right. I was able to, in the playing with the projector's blue screen, my machine and completely destroy my main boot to VHD image. But I'm a crazy person, and I backed it up the day before I flew out. So I did spend a couple hours restoring, but unfortunately I left a couple files that were in the VHD, so I'm just going to grab one from a different folder. But in either case, backups are good. Restores, those are sexy. And they're like, restores? Really? That's considered sexy? All right, so let's pop this puppy open, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you here what it looks like, and then we can run it from the other scene, although it's just going to do an export. So what we have here is a function called process result. Oh, so really, isn't that great? PowerPoint's amazing. It's PowerShell host also now. Sorry. Thank you. Okay, how's that? Is that better? Yes. Okay. So if we collapse this up, what we see here is a very simple routine that goes through and says, okay, go to the Hyper-V server, grab a VM name, tell me where you want to write it, and it reaches up, and this version uses the old syntax to show you how you can get the WMI namespace, get a hold of some objects, and then you go through and you say process result. And what's happening when we export, it comes up here, exports the VM, and then in processing result, we go through here, get a hold of the job object, and once we have a hold of the job object, we can go through and write out progress as things are executing. Okay? So let me take this script, which, like I said, I grabbed it from here, and we'll go over to the other machine, because on this machine, I only have the DC running, so I'm going to connect this one, which has two VMs. So we take a look here. There's a VM called simple, okay? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a folder to put it somewhere. How about we'll put it here on my D drive? Well, that's a good place. Temp is always good. Yeah, we like temp. All right, and we'll come over here to ISE. We'll do new. And looks like clipboard inheritance isn't working. Hold on. Oh, wait. It's because I copied the file, didn't I? There we go. Okay. And now we come over here and so we go export. Okay, so this is the script I'm going to run. And what's the host name? So we can do something like that. And then we want the name of the VM, which is called simple. And the location is going to be C:temp. And I get an error, because it's not set up to enable on this machine. So we'll do set execution policy, remote signed. Yes, I trust myself. It's my code. And then now it's running. Now notice what's happening here in the window. We're able to get a hold of the job object, get the data, and write it back to the screen and tell you what's going on. Now, just for the gentleman who asked about R2, this script is one that I kept around because it showed how to use the job objects when you need them. But this also will work on R2 because it uses the older interface for this one. It's not using the export PowerShell commandlet specifically. It's actually doing a little WMI magic. But in either case, notice it's able to export, and I see the percentage here on the screen, and I'm getting that same data back there. So you can provide some kind of status to users, what's going on, and once again, it saves you a lot of time. Okay, so this will finish for a little bit. It's done. And now if we go over here, oh, and that was good. I wrote it into, well, it's always good to write 10 gigs into, oh, 15, good. So there it is, it got copied over, and we're all good to go. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. So that's always the fun thing. If you notice and watch the do it at the same time with Hybrid Manager, you'll notice that they do the same thing. That's the very nature of the progress indicators. The biggest thing you're getting is that of anything is it's more it's alive and doing something rather than a specific number. I mean, come on, the Windows file copy dialog boxes are, you know, notorious for that. Although in Windows 8 Server 2012, they're a lot better. They provide a lot more data. I think they've really done a good job. But that's it's the way it is, and it's tends to be more of a WMI-ism, and which is the plumbing that Hyper-V is built on, their automation interfaces are built on top of, than so much as it is Hyper-V or Windows per se. But that's absolutely 100% normal. Yes, and you'll see that when I run some scripts that the PowerShell scripts do that. The whole point of that script is mostly to show the WMI job object more than anything. Now, so at this point I've covered a few things, and I wrote a couple scripts just to do a few things and show you some things that are able to do and how quickly it is to execute. So if we come over to my machine, and what I'm going to do is connect to the desktop on the other machine. And since I can't get to it from the other direction. And so you'll see I've got some different scripts that are available here for me to have fun with. And you can't see it again. See, this is one of those little button things. See, I did talk this morning with Mickey, and Mickey helped because he would keep reminding me, because he would start talking and he wanted to show something. All right, so there's files, name extensions. So the first one here is create five VMs. And so let's just copy all these locals so that we don't run into any. Okay. So this one shows you how we can go through and in one line of script build up five VMs with dynamic VHDs, specifically VHDX files, that are default size of 12 gig in size, have 512 megs of memory, and are hooked up to the wired switch. Okay, so if we go to my Hyper-V environment in the switch manager, I have a switch called wired. Now, over here, just run this. And you'll see it's just popping up a little. That's actually the VHD commandlet executing, showing that the hard disk is being created. And if we go over here, I now have a set of five VMs. Right? So one line of code, and you're off to the races. And the key thing there is that I didn't actually really have to do any input other than at the beginning, I created a variable here, 1 to 5. And that got replaced into the parameter there as part of this looping call. Okay, so that's pretty nice. Now, another thing you'll end up wanting to do is do things like snapshot VMs. Now, this one is where I show you how to use the loading data from a text file. So if we come over to snapshot VMs, what you'll see here is I write out the data that's coming from the command line, and then I say, okay, go forward, and for each VM in the array of VMs, well, where does this come from? Well, you'll see I'm calling get content, and the path is what's going to be passed as argument 0. I'm able to do the for each through it, then I say go ahead and get a hold of the VM object so I can manipulate it. Once I have the VM, I can come through here, and I call out, and I checkpoint it and create a undo snapshot. All right, so if we take a look at the arguments, then what I did is I just created a simple text file here. And so I can come over here. And we'll do snapshot VMs. And we'll do snapshot list.txt. And we'll run it. And it went through and snapshotted them. So that now if I go to 1, it's snapshotted, 3 snapshotted, and 5 has been snapshotted. Now, I have one that goes through and starts the VMs. Now, this one brings up the issue we talked about. When you have a large set of VMs, while you can highlight them through a command in the Hyper-V manager, for example, and say start, it'll just blindly try and start them all at once. In particular, when you're dealing with things like domain controllers and shared common SQL servers and other resources that need to be available first before another machine starts, you run into an unavailable issues as well as contention. What you can do here then is just wait for something to be started for a certain amount of time. So if we come over here to the ISE, you'll see this one has a function, and I got this from Ben Armstrong. Ben Armstrong, if you don't know him, is his blog is the virtual PC guy. He came to Microsoft when Microsoft acquired Kinetix and worked on the virtual PC product, and he is now a senior director, program manager on the Hyper-V team. And so his blog is got a lot of great information. He's also a game freak, so if you like to run games in VMs, he does that all the time. And he's been doing more PowerShell lately, so this is just a little script he wrote, and what happens is you come in, so I wrote this part, and then I borrowed his little function. So come in through, get the list of VMs, and then assuming it's operating normally, there's nothing wrong with it. So one of the things that you'll run into, particularly when you're doing things with laptops, is your direct attached storage. You forget to plug in a hard drive, forget to start it up. And what will happen inside Hyper-V Manager when you look at the status will say critical. So we're checking to make sure that the VM's at least there. And once again, this is just a simple test. And then come through here, and I call start VM and wait. And what happens is it calls start VM, which is a simple commandlet, and they just sit there and sleep until we're able to get a heartbeat back from the virtual machine saying it's okay. The only critical aspect about this implementation is that this assumes that the virtual machine that you're running is a supported operating system that has integration services and is providing the heartbeat status back. If you don't have that, you're going to just have to arbitrarily wait based upon the particular virtual machine. If you poke around, I've seen people do some crazy stuff, and I've done this before too, which is I will sit there and start by pinging, waiting for it to at least respond back in the network. And the next thing I'll try and do is often try and connect to some well-known resource, particularly a file share, right? If I can get all the way there, then I feel pretty good the machine's close to being up. Obviously, if it's something that hosts like SQL Server, then you can go the next step. SQL Server has a PowerShell object you can use, things like that. So those are things you want to do. This is one of the simplest ways to do it on a modern version of Windows with a modern guest that has integration services. It'll just tell you, hey, I'm alive, and at that point you can move forward. So nothing too exciting there, but I do start the VMs. And then the last script that I think is really fun is this one, this last one, which is called move. And notice it is literally one line of code, which is to live migrate a running virtual machine from one machine to another. It doesn't have to be running, but we can. So let's go over here just for giggles. So we'll start the virtual machine, and I'm going to change the host target to be HV530. And we want the F drive looks good. Let's go see if that's available over here. While that boots up really quick, yep, F. We'll create a folder there and do that. And we'll come back over. I think I put test there. There we go. So we'll save that and take a look. So here's the virtual machine running right there. So if you're not aware, to do live migration, you need to be on a domain. There has to be a trust between the machines. And if you go to Hyper-V settings, turn on live migrations, specify credentials, network you're going to use, etc. Make sure that's set, and then the moral equivalent in the GUI is simply move, and I'm doing this mostly to check to see if I can still get there. Okay, so I'll bring up the machine name, tell it I want to move the virtual machine's data, specify where, and this is browsing the other host, so there's my F drive. So come over here, and then finish. So you can do it that way, or you're going to do maintenance on your server and you want to move into another machine and keep them running. Well, just come over here and oh, nice. Failed to service connection. That's really nice. Well, I do apologize. I brought my own router. I really tried. But obviously I screwed something up in just moving between networks. So let's actually just see if it's lying to me, because I'm in the pain and suffering. This is what's odd, is it's like, hey, no problem. Come on down. You're the next contestant. No. Okay. Yeah, well, I apologize. So the bottom line is, if your network works, yes, sir. You know, I don't know off the top of my head. I assume there is, because basically it's whatever's there in the GUI. Everything they do, it's kind of this nice progression. The Hyper-V team took this approach, the SQL Server team took years ago, no secrets. So what they do, you can do. I just have to look it up. If you want to email me, I'll get you the command, or just we can look. Actually, let me show you one little thing about ISE. Hold on. Well, there's stop failover, and there's stop replication. So those are specific to the replica service. I'd have to look to see. It might be through stop job, get the job object. Okay. So those are some of the things you can do, and with the combination of either pipelining or input text boxes, et cetera, you have a lot of flexibility for doing things to more than one machine at a time. Now, the next step, though, is if you want to go a little further, you go further C#. And I put C# down because it's syntactically similar to PowerShell, in that you use curly braces. There's a lot of syntactical sugar that's similar. And I wrote my original sample in VB, but last night I was supposed to convert it, and I spent time restarting my machine. So I'll post both versions. I have a VB version, and then I'll update the C# version. But the whole point of using managed code as opposed to scripting is you can provide a richer experience from the user perspective, particularly if you want to integrate with other systems that may not be PowerShell friendly. When using managed code, you have obviously access to the full .NET framework, you have access to WMI, and you have access to Win32. And it's mostly an issue of maturity. One of the things when you're working with lots of object structures, you have the ability to use Link as an example. And you have rich tooling and the Visual Studio debuggers, remote access, and then depending upon the version of Visual Studio you use, you have even access to things like profilers, the ability to do load testing in conjunction with stuff. So you have a lot of power, as well as rich third-party libraries, both free ones out on the internet. NuGet is a feature of Visual Studio 2012 now, and NuGet has a rich community library that literally you just go and say, give me this library, and it downloads it, adds references, and does all the magic for you. Now, once again, I assume most of your IT pros, so this is something maybe you have installed regularly. The cool thing, though, is if you go to that address up there, or just, you know, use your favorite search engine, you want to get Visual Studio Express 2012 for Windows Desktop. And that particular version of Visual Studio will give you a GUI implementation that lets you create Windows programs. Now, the reason I bring this up is that there are other versions up there. Most notably, there is one for building Windows 8 applications. Windows 8 applications cannot talk to the Hyper-V APIs directly. Windows 8 applications, and to be clear, when we talk about those, we're talking about applications that run in this new Tiley shell Wonderworld. The best thing I can say about it. And don't get me wrong, there's some nice things about it. It's great for tablets, etc. And the frustrating thing is that you think maybe, you know, being able to have a nice little tool that automates Hyper-V would be cool to have on your tablet, right? Unfortunately, it can't talk to it. Now, that said, the Windows RT version of Windows doesn't run Hyper-V, so that's less of an issue. What you'd probably want to do is connect to your remote machines. Once again, you can't load the WMI libraries, and you can't directly talk to the PowerShell libraries from a Metro app. It's meant to be sandboxed, more protected, more safe. If you want to do that, what you'd have to do is put some kind of daemon in between the host you're talking to and the Metro app. And if, unless you're a programmer here, you're probably going, that sounds like a lot of work. It is. So this is why you want this one, where you can build a traditional Windows application, WPF, Windows Forms, a console app if you want. Although if you're going to do a console app, might as well, you know, PowerShell is probably just as good. But if you want to build something like I'm showing you here, this is the version you want. You'll be able to, it's free. You have to just register it. You just basically have to tell them, you know, hey, send me, harass an email, make me more of a developer. Download it, install it. You can do a web install or you can do an ISO download, and away you go. And once you have that, it's simply a matter of first creating a project. The big key here is that you're going to be programming WMI, and the interface to that is what's called system.management, and you simply add a reference to it. Once you do that, you create WMI objects, and for the gentleman who asked about the R2 thing, here's what happened. For whatever reason, good or bad, the way they've defined the namespace in WMI for accessing Hyper-V in R2 and 2008 proper is root virtualization. When they upgraded 2012 and the new version of Hyper-V and they created the PowerShell stuff, they created a new namespace because they did things differently and changed things around. And then what they did was they said, okay, well, we're going to build our GUI and our PowerShell stuff. We're going to build it against this new structure. And thus, if you try and issue commands, you can't even use the console, right? If you go to the Hyper-V manager, it will not let you connect to an R2 host and manage it. You have to RDP into the host or use like Windows 7 to talk to it. You know, I think it's kind of not nice that they did that. And so it is, I can understand frustration on that. That said, if you use the application code I have, it turns out that my code will run against R2 just fine as well as 2013. So that's another advantage of using full managed code in WMI directly, is that you can manage them with the both. Now, I did upgrade this one to use the V2 namespace, but if you just whack off namespace, I'm not doing anything right now other than there's one bit that's new, and you can just do it just fine against your R2 host. So that is one thing you can do here. Write a DLL and have it talk to it. And then the thing is, if you write the DLL like I'll show you in my sample, you could call that DLL from PowerShell. So there is some things you could do if you're stuck, you know, I mean, I'm sure, I mean, how many of you have still R2 or 2008 hosts? Yeah, okay. Would you guys like me to publish a version that works against R2 of the C# and the VB samples? By the way, who likes VB? Anybody still like VB? Okay, it's okay. There's no shame. I was a VB MVP, right? VB script was okay, you know? The thing is, you know, just if you do a lot of C#, your pinky gets really strong, so you can do this all the time. Okay, but so we'll take both samples, so that's no problem. I'll have them both languages, and what I'll do is I'll post and I'll put a little comment into where you change it for R2. In either case, once you have that, you can go away. Now, there's a lot of code here. I'm not going to go through every line by line, but I'm going to point out some key things that are going on here. And so let's switch, and let's get connected to the right machine. And I think it's that one. Yes. Okay. Okay, I am using Visual Studio Ultimate, but there's nothing fancy that I'm doing that for that. Okay. So the first thing you'll note is that I have... This would actually run. Thank you. You'll note over here that I have two projects. Okay, so a project in Visual Studio, if you're not aware, creates a unit of output. Okay, so we basically, when we compile this, we end up with a DLL, and the DLL, if written correctly, would be something you could call from PowerShell. And then I have a GUI written in Windows Forms. And the main reason I use Windows Forms is because I did the initial work on this a while back, and Windows Forms is very lightweight. It's just, it doesn't, you know, I'm not doing a bunch of pretty graphic stuff. So it's nice and lightweight, and it's really easy to just muck around in. Okay, and just to refresh you, if I run it, you specify a machine, and so we're going to connect to Odin. And so there's all the VMs I created. And notice when I select it, I'm getting all this data. So nothing's in progress. It's okay. It's got one processor. No memory is being used. Whereas if I select on this one, this is actually the VM I'm in. So I'm talking to the host, which is then telling me something about the VM I'm running inside. And you can see nothing's in progress. I've got memory at 4 gigs. Heartbeat's okay. I'm running Windows 8 Enterprise Evaluation. And life is good. And then I've even got my notes down here that tells me information about the VM. And by the way, the eval versions of Windows 8 is good for 90 days and one rearm. Server 2012 is good for 180 days and there's a couple rearms. What's really nice about the servers, you can download a pre-built VHD. And if you're going to be doing playing around with PowerShell and stuff, get yourself a couple of those VMs. Beat the heck out of them and just throw them away. You don't have to activate any licenses and stuff. You have to activate it for the trial. And it's not for production use. But if you're scripting and testing and learning, it's great to just get those and have them already installed and configured, ready to go, importing and all that stuff. And then you'll notice I got a bunch of commands here. Now, these are set to be single commands. But once you have the basis, you can then do exactly what I did, which is multi-select and go through and do things. Now, there's one little checkbox I want to mention here. It says include host. And if I click refresh, notice that the machine shows up. And a reason I want to point that out is because of the way they wrote the interfaces, when you go to execute collection commands, you say, give me these machines at certain levels within WMI namespace, the host is included. So you have to be aware of that. Because if you'll notice here, I have things like unknown, et cetera, and you know, weird creation time and other things. So it acts like a VM, but it's not a VM, right? And this has to do with the way the hypervisor works and that when you're working with a host operating system like I'm doing there, it actually is a pseudo VM, right? It's what's called the parent partition. All your VMs run in the guest partition. So that's why it shows up. There's a reason. But I did this to show you that when you look in the code, you understand. And then all the commands are pretty straightforward. Probably the neatest one at the end, though, is this. And I have a slide for this, which is you can run PowerShell scripts from your C# app also. Okay? So let me show you some of the key things you need to know. All right. And as you saw, my GUI is a tour de force of application design. Hey, they're lined up, okay? So connect and load. So the first thing to understand is that all the core work is being run out of this class called VM Manager. And VM Manager lives in here. If you're new to Visual Studio, when you have a method like this, press F12 by default, or right-click and say go to definition, it'll take you to the code. And then this comes in here, takes all the parameters and connects, and then away you go. And then you'll notice right here, I've already left it in there. If you just use this namespace, and I'm going to prove a point. I'm going to uncomment this and comment this. Notice it still works. Okay? Now, there are some oddities in that if you want some of the newer commands, you'll have trouble. That's why. All the commands in here, though, are all, except for the PowerShell stuff, is 100% compatible against R2 and 2012. Okay? So you change the line of code. You should be able to take this to your R2 server and run it and do all the things I'm showing you here. Now, in either case, we come through and I just do some checking. But the key thing that happens here is that we're creating what's called a scope text. And we're creating a management scope object. A management scope object is a generic WMI object. It has really nothing to do with Hyper-V per se. Okay? And so the key thing is if you're going to program Hyper-V at this level, you want to go to WMI textbooks. That's what you want to look to for help. Okay? As far as understanding some of the weird syntax. You're going to see some of my code and go, this looks nasty. And it is. It's unpleasant. I'm not going to lie to you. Especially if you compare the fact that you can do one line of code in PowerShell with pipeline and just do stuff. But you get a level of control and the ability to have the GUI around it and the reusability that's not exactly the same. And there's just a number of methods here, like get virtual machine, that goes through. In this example, you pass in the machine name you want. It executes what's called a query. So you pass it the scope you're looking in, which is that namespace that we popped up earlier. And then the query is kind of like pseudo SQL, right? And I'm basically looking at an MSVM computer system. So this represents the host machine. And I'm telling it to go through and find element name for that particular machine name. And we go through, call get, returns. We get the results. If we do, then I instantiate a new VM. And what it is, I model my own VM objects, and then here's some of the data I put in here. Right, creation time, guest, heartbeat, etc. These are all exposed. And then unfortunately, what you're going to find is a lot of the objects return arrays of numbers. A good example is if we go down to
let's see. Actually, we'll come over here and go to that property, operational status. So operational status, notice we basically check the status, and then notice we look at the return values. So 32773 is exporting a virtual machine. So they don't provide, they just provide a raw number, so it's a kind of an alt-tabbing experience back and forth, or at least hopefully dual monitors to get those codes. But the bottom line is, it's a process of getting into the namespace. Once you have the namespace, get the object you want to work on, which you can do one of two ways. You can do a collection, or you can do an individual search. So here is the get a specific one. So this is where we use a query. And then load virtual machines, notice instead, goes out and said, okay, go ahead and get the instances. So it just says get them all. And once it has it, we then look for Microsoft Hosting Computer System. And that's how we exclude the host from the list. Once we do that, we then go through, add it to our collection, and that collection is this, the data bound to the GUI. Right? Management objects, management classes, and then it's just whether you're working with a single object or a collection. Same syntax. Object searcher uses a query, comes back with a collection, in this case instead of an instance. All right? And then I've got some helper functions in here that translate numbers into enums, etc. And that's it. And probably the only, the geekiest thing in there is probably the code that does the thumbnail conversion. For whatever reason, they weren't nice and provided a nice array. They actually, it's, and part of it has to do with WMI is built on top of native Windows code that has a heritage in COM and the native Win32 stuff. So it turns out that when you want to get the thumbnail, let's go here to VM. Whoops. Okay, and why is my keyboard acting up? Because it doesn't like me. So here's thumbnail. So here it returns a bitmap, but if we go look at it, what it does is this nice function here. It goes and checks the size of it. You can actually make them bigger. Goes through, gets the raw WMI object, goes and finds the related object, then goes through, passes the data structure in, calls it to the system, then brings it back and does an interop call to do some blitting of the data into a local data structure, and it gives you a .NET compatible bitmap. In all honesty, that's probably the nastiest bit of code other than you're programming WMI. Like I said, WMI looks a little unpleasant, but you get used to it after a while. In either case, lots of power, lots of flexibility, and if you want to go for broke, you go to your project and you add a reference to system.management.automation. And you'll notice this is an assembly down in the PowerShell system. If you do that, then you can update your code to do the following. Create what's called a run space. If you are worried about the policy and you, assuming your GUI has privileges to do this, you can elevate the privileges for the script execution, specify the path, and make sure if it's there. And if it is, create a pipeline. And in this case, I'm just going to read the script as is, but you can read and write parameters both directions. And you call invoke, and that will run the script against it. So if we take a look at this one, this one's in my demos folder on my C drive. So if we take a look, right? So this one is going to create the BVMs. And so if we run the application, connect, and now run the PowerShell script. And of course, you can run this asynchronously. You can put up a progress bar. And for the gentleman who didn't like the number thing, you can maybe do the numbers a little more accurate. But we'll give this a couple seconds, and it'll refresh. And then now I have the BVMs created on the host. And if we go over to, you'll see there they are too. Okay? Right. And so to basically call PowerShell from C#, you need a reference to the system.manage.automation interfaces, and then use a pipeline objects invoke method, assuming you provide it with the text. And by the way, I loaded a text file. You can also just write text directly in. So you can provide an editor experience if you wanted it, whatever you wanted to do for your particular system.
Now that said, you might wonder, well, Brian, can I call commandlets? Absolutely, you could, but now you're getting to this blurry line of, well, you know, if you're gonna call commandlets, you can also call .NET code directly also, it just really depends. That said, someone's thinking, but wait a minute, weren't some of those Hyper-V commandlets a lot nicer? Well, exactly. So you can kind of mix and match the two to suit your needs, depending on what you're really trying to do. And that said, of course, there might be someone here saying, well, guess what? PowerShell will even let you create GUIs. You're right, it will. That said, the editing experience I found in creating PowerShell GUIs is at least a little bit desired compared to what I have in Visual Studio. And once again, since you can get a really good version of Visual Studio that's free, yes, free as a beer, just have to register 30 days, that's it. I have a hard time going that far. It's like, anybody ever build GUIs, or dialogues, I should say, in Excel? Excel, anybody? You could, you would go and define the layout on an Excel spreadsheet, and you'd call it macro, look it up, I tell you no lies, and you could pop up custom dialogues in Excel, Excel 3.0, 16-bit. Yes, I'm a little old and demented and sad, but very social. So if you see me out tomorrow night in Vegas, we can have some fun. So on that note, I'll say thank you very much for coming. I apologize that I had to kind of jump around. I mean, everything got to work eventually, except for the live migration, which it moves the VM. It's cool, but that's all it does. But in general, I think there's a lot of compelling stuff there. I will zip up all this stuff and put it on my blog. I will do that sometime tonight and get that up there. So if you want it, all my contact information is on the slide. The slides are posted on ComNet. You can go download them right now. But there's my email address, there's my Twitter handle, there's my blog address, The Root, where I will post things for download. And ultimately, I hope you enjoyed the session. I hope you enjoyed MMS. It's a really great show. Lots of good stuff to learn from. And I know I'm learning stuff, so hopefully you are too. And we, of course, want to hear from you. We take evaluations very seriously, so please fill it out. And, oh, you guys win prizes? I can't, but you can. So fill out your evals, tell us what you think, and you know, good or bad, I'd love to hear feedback, so if you have a second, put some comments in or throw something at me. Otherwise, have a good one, and the session will be online for later review, and take care. If you have questions, there's a mic. Otherwise, I'm going to give you a few minutes back. Looks like 2 minutes and 48 seconds before full wrap-up, so you can beat the remote lunch crowd. Thank you. So if you have questions, go to the mic so they can record it. Otherwise, if you don't want to be on the mic, you can come up and talk to me while I tear down. Okay.